Radio EcoShock. Can we grab still more carbon from the air and put it in the soil? We go now to New England, to St. Albans, Vermont, to meet Abe Collins. He is co-founder of Carbon Farmers of America. Abe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Good to be here. The two organizations I'm working with now is New Soil Quantum and the Soil Carbon Coalition.
Tell us about your own roots, Abe. How did you develop your skills in growing soil as well as food?
I was in Arizona during the 1990s and living and working with a Navajo community. And their land was badly degraded, and the young men and women I was working with, it had become very clear to them that the health of their communities was entirely tied to the health of the land. And so we embarked on this journey of trying to understand what was the cause of desertification and how to reverse it. And we did a lot of work with rainwater harvesting, tree planting, gardens, and, you know, opportunistically irrigated agriculture. But there was always this question in the background, and that is, how do the livestock fit in? Because Navajos are pastoralists and, you know, herd sheep and cattle. And the old people had always said to us, when we had big herds and moved in cycles, this land was a sea of grass. And when we were subjected to this forced stock reduction and parked in the same place, the land turned into a desert. And you looked out and you could see that the livestock, where they were grazing, the land looked very poor. There was erosion and so forth. But there was this recurring message from the old people that, hey, when we had big herds and we moved around, things worked. We ran into the work of Alan Savory and his development of holistic management at some point, and he figured out that indeed those old people were right. It isn't the livestock per se that are causing the damage. It's the management, the human management and decision-making that leads to some number of animals parked in a spot. And that was the opposite of how the plants and the animals had co-evolved. So that by changing the management, you could get the landscape working again. You know, mimic the patterns that evolved, let's say, with bison being chased by wolves, where you had high intensity of animals for a short time, you know, exposed to the plants and soils, and then recovery and just keep doing that. And Savory had figured out, and through trial and error and a lot of practical development, that desertified landscapes could be turned back into healthy land through the planned grazing of livestock. So that was a big starting point for me, and there's just really, in the last 100 years especially, there's been dozens of methodologies, approaches, tools developed through which grazing and agricultural management can improve topsoil. And as a farmer myself, when I eventually moved back to Vermont around 2000 and put these ideas into practice, I saw them bear fruit, soil becoming more fertile quite rapidly, typically using livestock, grazing, and other methods such as physical aeration of soils. But there's so many tools, I won't get into them all.
What kind of operation are you running now?
This is historically a dairy farm, and we've chosen to do custom grazing of beef in the last few years, and that's been an exciting switch because what we discovered through dairy with the frequent monitoring, you know, your daily dipstick monitoring on your bulk tank, we were able to take the lessons we learned about animal performance from dairy and apply it to beef, and we've found that we're able to get very good gains on just grass and get a lot of productivity out of the land. And also, we have these instances where we've combined different management and gotten improved soil.
Abe, I did some part-time farming myself. It had to be part-time because nobody could make a living at it where I was. It was kind of old-fashioned with a tractor, a standard plow, discs and all that to break up heavy soil. I did add manure and I grew some cover crops like rye, but was I still losing soil and carbon, do you think?
It's hard for me to say what your outcomes were. There's so many particulars, you know, wherever you may be, but some of the big rules are that soil needs to be covered. So if the soil is covered year-round, and hopefully even green year-round, you know, with living plants, and that may be a perennial base or that may be cover crops, these are some of the conditions. And there's others. For soil formation to occur, you need photosynthesis, the conversion of air and water into sugars, and then you need that covered soil. And then there's a process of humification by microbes where they synthesize organic matter in forms that they're all temporary, but some are just temporary even in the terms of 1,000 years. Physical compaction of the soil is often a limiting factor because soils the organisms in soils, just like you and me. They need air. These are some of the conditions, and it sounds like you were probably meeting some of those conditions, although in some instances you might have been a few steps forward and one step back.
Well, textbooks tell us it takes nature about 1,000 years to make an inch of soil. How fast could a farmer do it?
I, as much as anyone, want more and more data on this. There are instances, scientifically validated or quantified instances, of fairly more rapid soil formation than 1,000 years to get an inch. One of the practitioners and developers of a method who I'm really inspired by was a guy named P.A. Yeomans. He was an Australian who got into farming and realized that the notion of conserving soil when you had no soil to begin with was not that practical. And what he discovered was that a combination of, in effect, planned grazing, grazing animals at fairly high density, removing them, letting the grasses recover, and physically aerating the soil with a subsoil or plow, he was able to build inches of soil per year. So not 1,000 years to build an inch, but inches per year. And since he developed that in about the mid-1950s, there's been a lot of people around the world who have taken that further and have seen the similar results, and we have too, where you can get many inches of conversion of subsoil to topsoil. So you're taking the mineral, formerly largely inert subsoil, and getting the aerobic biological processes going in them so that you suddenly go from having, let's say, 6 inches of topsoil to, in a matter of a couple of years, a foot of topsoil working. We were really influenced by one of P.A. Yeomans' sons, Alan Yeomans, who wrote a book called Priority One. And in it, since the late 80s, he'd written a paper about 1989 entitled An Agricultural Solution to Global Warming. And in it, he did the math, and he found that a few percentage point increase in the organic matter or soil carbon, the equation would work out that that would essentially be extracted from the atmosphere and put into the soil, where you stop having it be in excess in the atmosphere, a pollution problem. And when you have more in the soil, suddenly you have water holding, fertility, you know, plant growing organic matter. So it was based on that notion and the idea of farmers being paid to provide yet another environmental service to the rest of society beyond food production, which would be addressing climate change. And it was early in the game in terms of people understanding soil as an important place for carbon to end up where we need it, and if we get it there, we're extracting it from the air. The business never cash flowed, but it led us to do a lot of thinking and working on this. And carbon trading may be contentious and problematic and too big in some ways to make markets really work. What I think that I personally, you know, my learning curve has been, when you improve soil, a whole bunch of things happen, including regulation of water in a watershed. There are many local benefits to soil formation, and we may do well to kind of bring it closer to home, because when things are at the scale of global agreements and accords and economics, and you have a long time between proposed payments and proposed benefits to society, it makes more sense to bring the markets closer to home. So when we build soil, we can address flooding, drought, wildfire, dust storms, landslides, erosion damage to infrastructure, any number of problems like this, water quality and water quantity, and we can make the water more available. And things like natural hazards mitigation and water issues are very meaningful and carry real economic weight on the watershed scale. So we've moved more towards that, but it does not change our starting assumptions that improving or increasing soil organic matter is really one of the most direct ways to address climate change problems.
How did you make out with Hurricane Irene? We're going to have more of these extreme rainfall events. So how did it work out for you in New England there when we got all that rain?
Here in my town of St. Albans, we had a historically wet spring with flooding everywhere, and then we had a drought that was unprecedented. There was no living memory of a drought this bad. And then it was broken by Irene. For us, we only got 3 1/8 inch from, it was Tropical Storm Irene by the time it got to us. And that broke the drought, which was welcome for us. For my hometown, just a few hours south, it was very hit hard. It was every road and every bridge was destroyed. People couldn't get in and out of the town. A lot of Vermont suffered badly and had massive damage to infrastructure. One of the things that became clearer was that improved soil health in the state of Vermont could have mitigated some of that damage. The more carbon is in your soils and the better the cover, the more that raindrops soak in, are held, are used for plant growth, gradually trickle down to recharge water tables and come out in springs and streams. We need more healthy soil in Vermont and anywhere to be able to give ourselves the security of against extreme weather events like drought and flooding.
So you have just launched the Vermont Carbon Challenge. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The Soil Carbon Coalition is a nonprofit that myself and Peter Donovan and our good friend who passed away recently, Terry Gompert, we co-founded that about 5 years ago. And one of the notions is that practical farmers and ranchers everywhere are doing management that's improving soil health and providing more environmental services. That is not necessarily what gets into the peer-reviewed journals. And we're looking to, in effect, change the leadership around this conversation of soil health and provision of environmental services by doing practical monitoring of practical farmers wherever the service is desired. So the idea is a challenge to monitor soil carbon on farms and ranches and have those farmers do their management, you know, their real whole farm management with an eye towards soil health improvement, and come back in 3, 6, and 9 years and measure again, monitor again, and see what sort of change has been achieved. This isn't just something that only the experts can tell us how to do. Practical people farming and ranching on the land have management that's yielding good results, and we're looking to identify that and reward it and have that influence policy.
Most of my listeners are city dwellers. They buy their food in the supermarket. Why should they care about what you are doing? And is there some way that they can relate to this new movement in agriculture?
I think absolutely that the interface between the rest of society and the land are the farmers and grazers. And the people in the cities, they rely on the services that we land managers provide. And I've gone through the list a little bit, but climate regulation, food production, the quality of the food that we put into our bodies, and the environmental services like watershed regulation, mitigation of flooding, drought, wildfire, and so forth. These things really do come from soil health, and it's amazing what a range of goods come from soil, but currently farmers are only paid for the quantity of production. And in a sense, that's a perverse incentive where we get what we're paying for. We're getting drying out aquifers and we're getting flooding and wildfires and so forth because the land management is yielding decreasing, and you know, every year decreasing soil health. So cities are entirely dependent on the services that come from soil, and thinking about economics in terms of what is it that we want from land managers and how can we set up policy and economics that reward them for improving the soil that give us the security that we need in the cities and the goods and services. It's a good way to begin. So buying from producers who are producing good quality, not only food, but soil, is one way to think about it, but also thinking about the larger economic policies that would reward farmers for increasing their soil organic matter, their soil carbon. And one of the basics of that is you want that pretty much to be based on performance. So that implies soil and landscape monitoring, things like water quality, groundwater levels, soil organic matter levels, things like this.
That's a whole new regime you're proposing and a whole new way of looking at farming, I think, and I hope it succeeds. It must succeed. Can you give us a website or two to follow up?
Let's see. The soilcarboncoalition.org is a great place to start, and managingholes.com and managingholes, W-H-O-L-E-S, is another good place. And I just, you know, want to say that I think you have a payment for ecosystem services trend that's been happening actually for decades and is really gaining momentum these days. And we're seeing more and more proposed schemes, and I say schemes in a not a diabolical sense, but just plans or pilot projects, where cities are working with land managers to incent good land management for the environmental benefits with real economic costs, you know, or benefits to their cities. New York City is one great example where it was either an $8 billion water treatment plant or they improved the health of the upstream watershed, and they achieved the same outcome for about $1.5 billion. There's many instances like this developing, and I think it's a good line of thinking, and we just have to be aware that there's going to be a learning process. But we need what farmers are producing just beyond the food. We need the environmental quality and security that comes from healthy soil.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with Abe Collins. Thank you so much, Abe.
Thank you, Alex.
This seems to be the Radio EcoShock Farming Show. You don't need to pay attention, unless, of course, you eat, and you plan to survive in anything, like a normal climate. We all recognize the need to eat more local food. In the West, that means farmers, but we're running out of them. At least 40% of all American farmers are over the age of 55. To have local food, a new crop of farmers must be planted. We've covered this in a past Radio EcoShock show. On April 16, 2010, I talked with Severin von Scharner Fleming of Greenhorn Radio. The Greenhorns link up young farmers and encourage more. Find those links in my blog at ecoshock.info. In Cubaros County, North Carolina, the average age of a farmer is 58. So they started an incubator farm to help gardeners become market farmers. We have a presentation by the Cubaros County organizer, Aaron Newton. He spoke in early November at the Aspo Peak Oil Conference in Washington, D.C.
We're going to get right on to what my community is doing in terms of trying to rebuild our local food system. Now, I am a farmer, and I am a writer and a teacher, and I'm also a land planner. My degree's in landscape architecture. I'm going to talk to you today as a government employee because I am the local food systems program coordinator for Cabarrus County. I work out of the county manager's office. My position was created a year and a half ago by our board of commissioners, our elected officials in Cabarrus County, and our local government is spearheading this effort of rebuilding our local food economy. So I want to talk from the standpoint of what local government has done where I live to get this going. So a little geography to get you started. This is Charlotte, North Carolina, right here. Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, about 1 million people plus, so a very large city. And Cabarrus County is about 22 miles northeast of Charlotte, a much more rural community. I live in a very rural community just outside of a large metropolitan area. So there's a large demand for food, and we have a lot of agriculture. The development that has taken place is right here, the city of Concord, which is the county's seat. In 2007, and then ratified in 2008, the county came up with our central area plan. And part of that plan, it was decided that we would protect the areas that we had in the county that were involved in agriculture. The area here in green is zoned for agriculture. The area in light green below it is zoned what we call countryside residential, which means small farms and homesteads. As part of this central area plan, the city of Concord agreed not to extend utilities to the upper northeast corner of the county. We basically created a de facto growth boundary to protect this area that's involved in agriculture. But in doing so, the county recognized that if you're going to protect an area and set it aside for agriculture, you have to make sure that it's economically viable, that the people that own that land, that work that land, can make money in agriculture. All of the folks that you see here that are actively farming in the county got a letter, and they were invited to a town hall meeting. And 200 of them showed up. So these are the farmers in the county, and the county staff and the Board of Commissioners asked them. They said, well, what do you need to remain economically viable or to become more economically viable and stay in agriculture? And the farmers said they had four things that they wanted. So out of that meeting, what we discovered is, number one, they said, we're old. The average farmer in Cabarrus County is 58 years old, and that's pretty close to the national average. They said, we're going to be retired in 15 years, we're going to be dead in 25, and somebody else has to work this land. If you plan for this to be ongoing and continue as an agriculturally productive area. So the county's response was to create an incubator farm, a 30-acre farm that was bequeathed to the county by Elma C. Lomax. And this is a program where we help gardeners make the leap to market farming. This is our third season. We had 16 students out on the land learning how to farm. They get access to a small plot of their own, but then there's shared equipment and resources. There's a heated and an unheated greenhouse, two tractors, a post-harvest handling facility, triple bay wash sinks, packing tables, rapid refill ice machine, 20 by 10-foot walk-in cooler, irrigation system, all of the things that you would need to try your hand at farming without actually having to go and buy a 10-acre farm and drop, $250,000. The idea is that they stay here for approximately 3 to 5 years, learning the business of farming, not only the production, but also the taxes, the business plans, the marketing, all of the other things that you need to know to be successful. And then they spin off onto their own acreage, and this is our attempt to grow more farmers in Cabarrus County. So that was the first thing they said. We said, we need more farmers. The second thing the farmers said that they needed was the rebuilding of our local infrastructure, our agricultural infrastructure. After corn and soy, the other thing that we do well in Cabarrus County is beef cattle. Now, not to the extent that some of you folks in the Midwest do, but at any given time, there's 7,500 or so head of cattle in Cabarrus County with no way to slaughter them nearby. The closest slaughter facility is about a 2 hours drive, which means 2 hours to drop off your animals and 2 hours home, and then later in the week, 2 hours to retrieve your meat and 2 hours home. So it's 8 hours worth of driving. So despite the fact that we have enough cattle to meet roughly a third of the demand for beef in our county, less than 1% of the beef that's consumed in Cabarrus County is actually raised there. So the county is building a slaughter facility and contracting with a local family to run it. The third thing that they said is that they didn't really know what they needed. They said, we need really a comprehensive food system assessment to help us figure out what it is that we need going forward. We need to know what it looks like to eat in Cabarrus County. We need to know what it looks like to grow food in Cabarrus County. And so the county contracted with the Center for Environmental Farming Systems, CEFS, to do this work of trying to figure out where we are now so that we can realistically figure out where we want to go. We did this in two phases. The first phase was just a quantitative look at farming and food in Cabarrus County, USDA, Census Bureau, North Carolina Department of Agriculture numbers. And out of those numbers, we identified quite a few issues. Phase two was about drilling down to those issues through a more qualitative approach, more than 60 interviews with people in the county who could bring to bear knowledge and experience about the issues that were raised out of the numbers that we looked at. And this report was just released, was just given to the Board of Commissioners in October. So this is fresh information that we have. And now that we understand where we are, we can create a vision for where we want to go and realistically figure out how to get there. The fourth thing that the farmers said that they wanted is someone to continue to do this work ongoing. They said it's great that we're all here together in this meeting, but going forward, how are we going to take a comprehensive look at our food system and make changes to it? In putting together this Food Policy Council, we recognized that what we really needed was a diverse group of folks who represented different components of the food system, not just a growers' guild, but people from throughout the food system. So we do have five producers that serve on the Food Policy Council. We also have folks from the processing industry. We have folks from the prepared food industry, healthcare, education, hunger relief and food access folks who are on the council. Upper left-hand corner, you can see here Gina Guthrie and Tina Farmer. Tina's the nutrition coordinator for Cabarrus County Schools. Gina's a caterer, and they're giving classes at a public school. Colleen McDaniel's one of the beginning farmers here, and she's working with inmates. They're growing food, and she's teaching them how to cook. So it's a very diverse group of folks. They meet every second Thursday in an open meeting. They get from the county support, including me as staff support, but also meeting spaces, business cards. We're mostly paperless, so they're operating off of memory card. So those were the four things that came out of our meeting, our town hall style meeting with the farmers. One of the first things the Food Policy Council did was create a local food marketing campaign. So they all on their own came up with this logo here and licensing agreements that are helping to bring together different components of the food system. So if you're a farmer in Cabarrus County, you can apply to use this as part of your marketing strategy. If you're a restaurant and you meet some basic guidelines, you can use it as part of your marketing strategy. But it also puts those folks in touch with each other, because if a restaurant wants to use this label, they're going to seek out the farmers who are producing within Cabarrus County. So it's a way to build in relationships between folks in the food system that don't necessarily talk all the time. It's also served as a pretty good banner for the calls. So the T-shirts, the bumper stickers, all of the things that you can imagine that people can use to show their support in the community, even if they're just folks who are eating local food, they can show their support for what we're doing in terms of rebuilding the local food economy. So we have this diversity within the Food Policy Council itself, but the council has also begun to engage with other groups that are already doing this work in the community. Our farmers market is organized by a 25-year-old nonprofit organization. So what happens when the Food Policy Council gets involved with the nonprofit that runs the farmers market? Well, you get your first annual Harvest Gala, which was a ticketed event to serve as a fundraiser for the Piedmont Farmers Market and their expansion plans. So this is an example of this group not only being very diverse within itself and addressing issues and making policy and program recommendations, but also beginning to partner with existing organizations to make the efforts more robust. In terms of specific policies, one of the first things the Food Policy Council did was recommend to the Board of Commissioners that had just created them that the commissioners adopt a local food purchasing policy for the county. They kind of turned around and said, all right, well, if you're really serious about this food thing, put your money where your mouth is. We want you to buy 10% of all the food served at county catered events and small department sponsored meetings from within North Carolina, with an emphasis on the food coming from Cabarrus County. The second step we're already moving into, which is the larger contracts the county has with food providers, the jail system, Department of Aging, the school system, and our arena and events center. And two of the four have already signed on. So we're already looking at those larger food contracts signing on to this 10% purchasing policy to start to begin to, as they ask us to, put our money where our mouth is. I wanted to talk about my position. So my position was created by the Board of Commissioners to sort of help organize all of these efforts. The idea was that there needed to be staff assistance to the Food Policy Council so that while this is not a top-down issue directive, it's not me telling them what to do, I still allow them the space to be creative and address the policy and programs that they think necessary. The idea is that they don't have to do the grunt work of finding meeting space and taking minutes and setting up agendas and that sort of stuff. So I serve them in that capacity and also serve as the superintendent to the incubator farm. So the same thing there. I make sure the tractor is fueled, that the gate gets locked at night. I wanted to just offer a few items of advice for folks who are looking to revitalize their local food systems. Number one would be the collaborative efforts that will be necessary. I think collaboration, as I show here on the slide, is diversity plus communication. So finding ways to put all of the different stakeholders in the same room together so that they can talk and solve problems comprehensively. Secondarily, the funding is definitely a key, especially if we're facing a contractionary economy. So when we think about funding in terms of any of these policies or programs, we're thinking in three phases. The first phase is how to get it built, how to get the actual infrastructure in place on the ground. And the third phase is a self-funding phase. We need to get these programs and policies to a point where they're actually funding themselves as quickly as possible. We know we're not going to be able to continue to draw money from the county. But the second phase is the one I wanted to hit today specifically. All of these green areas that we saw in the earlier slide that are being actively farmed, for tax purposes, are in present use valuation. What that means is they're being taxed based on their agricultural production, not their value as real estate. And this is a real tax savings to the folks who are able to take advantage of this. When they leave that program, most counties dump that money right back into the general fund. But in Cabarrus County, we drop it into a special fund that can only be used to support sustainable agricultural programs. So that pays for my salary. That pays to keep the lights on at the incubator farm in that intermittent period between getting started up out of the ground and being able to be self-funding. So that middle funding phase is really key for us and has helped us be successful rather quickly. The other two things that we remind ourselves all the time is not to reinvent any wheels and to make sure that whatever we're doing is replicable and repeatable in other communities. So, for instance, when the Food Policy Council wanted to develop a local food marketing campaign, the first thing that they did was go out and take a look at what was being done in other parts of the country and borrowed the best of what they saw and maybe learned from some of the mistakes of some other communities. And at the same time, we're trying to make the work that we're doing available to other people in other communities around the country so that they don't have to reinvent the wheel, so that you all don't have to reinvent the wheel. When you're going to create something, you can look around and find examples. And if we can be an example to other communities, we're happy to do so. And that's all I have. Thank you.
I found so many good ideas in that talk by Aaron Newton. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, for this presentation, and to Jerry Williams for being there to record it. We've traveled from providing your own local food all the way to reversing climate change through better farming. I'm Alex Smith. Find our website at ecoshock.org and find notes about our show at ecoshock.info. Thank you for taking this time to care about your world.